options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Morning, I'm Darrell Jones, Director of Research at HedgEye. Welcome to the second installment of In the Arena. Second installment also has somebody from Palm Beach. First one, we had Bill Pulte. Now we have Doug Kass. They're enjoying the nice weather down there. But we're excited to have Doug on. You know, he's been a very prolific writer, investor, analyst of the markets for a long time. And Doug, I thought I would maybe get you to kick it off by giving us a little bit of your background. Obviously, a lot of people know who you are, but maybe they don't know what you've done over the course of your career. So maybe we can start with that.
Sure. I would start by saying I am sure I am the only harness driver and neater reader hedge fund manager that you've ever interviewed.
I'm sure that's true.
So I have a classic academic background. I went to a small school upstate New York, then went to graduate school at Princeton University and got my was at a PhD program in philosophy, actually, and got my MBA at Wharton. After the cover of Time magazine had a list of PhDs in terms of what they paid, and my mother called me and said, "I think I should leave Princeton and go to business school." My dad had died, you know, a pretty humble background, not from a wealthy family. I actually had to move in when I graduated Wharton and started working on Wall Street with my mom to support her. But I had a grandmother, Grandma Koufax, Jeannie Koufax. Sandy is my first cousin, pitcher. By the way, let me just digress a second. It's wonderful to, I have nothing prepared, as you know.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's wonderful to square the circle with you, Keith, and HedgEye.
Yeah.
As you recall, we had a very bumpy start to our relationship.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting.
And actually, it was my fault because I didn't know him. Keith was snarky like me, and I was taken aback by it and really hadn't properly examined his process and rigor.
Yep.
And when I did, obviously, I became a devotee and subscriber and have been since then. But we have a lot of things in common. We have a relationship with Yale. I've taught since 2011 Dr. Schiller's course in advanced economics in the business school. As you know, Robert won the Nobel Prize for economics back in 2013. I also taught, do you know Dr. Martin Schubeck?
I don't know, but yeah, I know the name.
He's one of the fathers of numbers theory, so yep, we have a lot in background with regard to fractal math and that sort of stuff. We have a lot involved with athletics. I was a harness race driver. I wasn't a hockey player, but you're all hockey players. So importantly, we have a lot in common with Dan Holland. Dan, I worked with Dan often when he was on the Kudlow Report. I was on probably twice a week.
Yep.
And made that call for a generational low in equities back in March 2009. We're also independent thinkers, I think, Seabreeze, Cass, Jones,
yep,
Keith, and yep, HedgEye. We don't suffer fools lightly, and we're not fans of group stink. We base our decisions on analysis and not narratives. I like to say that Karl Marx once said, "Religion is the opiate of the masses." I say social media and narratives on financial TV are the opiate of the masses.
Yeah, I think your point on social media is a really good one. You know, and you know, that's to your point, where we kind of originally got off on the wrong foot and then over time got to know each other better and appreciate each other. But I do think, you know, social media, to your point, is really something that in many ways hurts society. There are some helpful benefits, but it's just become pervasive with groupthink at times as well.
There's so much vitriol, and you have a lot of people on Twitter in particular that are shrouded in anonymity and live in the cheap seats and never play the game on a field. And, you know, you never know their names, and it's very easy for them to take pot shots. I'm actually off Twitter for a little while right now.
Yeah.
But so anyway, I graduated Wharton, second my class, an MBA program. Went to Kitty Peabody speaking at Pulte as a housing analyst, became the number one housing analyst. I was 22 years old. Went to Putnam Management in Boston. I followed banks, whole builders, conglomerates, and ultimately became the part-time economist at Putnam. My wife and I were from Manhattan, from New York, and all our friends were in New York, and she wanted to go back to New York, and I wanted to go back. My family was there. And I basically ran a firm called Glickenhaus, which, you know, pros kind of know. Mostly people don't know about it, but we built up a several billion-dollar company, investment management firm, and we were the number one performing independent investment manager in the country for a five-year period. Just the three of us started in municipal bonds, and I ran the equity business. I went on my own, did a couple of deals, some good, some bad, acquisition M&A deals. Ended up working at Omega Advisors twice as a senior portfolio manager and for a while director of research. And Lee taught me a lot, taught me to get in early in the morning before 5 o'clock. Now I get in, I start work at 4 o'clock. He taught me to go belly to belly with managements, to know the companies better than the CFOs knew them. And it worked out well for me, and I'm still very close to Lee. In fact, I recently did a fireside chat for him at for the Harvard Business School and Wharton schools of clubs of Florida. I went on my own. We had a successful partnership, a hedge fund called Seabreeze Partners, which actually started as a dedicated shorts fund. Jonesy?
Yeah.
I thought that there was demand for a non-correlated investment manager who conservatively shorted stocks and had good risk control. And we were doing quite well. And then 2009 happened, and we were doing so well, we became an ATM for people that lost money on the long side. Dan right. Allen could tell about my frequent visits and my bearishness with Larry Kudlow on CNBC. I ultimately, we were doing quite well building up the assets, and I got cancer. And then my kidney failed, and I just didn't know what the outlook was, so I redeemed out all my investors. Continued to work at Yale, wrote my book, and I was working at thestreet.com starting in 1997. I continued to do that, in which I had a daily diary of financial blog. I've actually been doing that for now 27 years.
That's amazing. I'm just curious, how do you feel that writing every day helps your process? Because you are a very prolific writer, and I would think that putting your thoughts down on paper is something that actually helps you as an investor as well.
It's so important to me, Jonesy, and the real benefit is when I screw up, which we often do.
Right.
I always say, unlike the characters on financial TV, CNBC, that I'm often wrong and always in doubt. And they never seem to be wrong and never in doubt. And actually, I was explaining to you before we got on air, I had a deal for a second book to do a book on financial media, but I decided for a variety of reasons, most importantly, it was too time consumptive. And what happened was, once I got better, and I'm perfectly healthy now. About 2 years ago, I started Seabreeze back up, and, you know, we raised, it's a small hedge fund. We raised about $100 million. And actually, that's Scott Budner, the same CEO that I had in the former Seabreeze. But I find that it's really good when I make mistakes to go back and understand where I erred in my analysis.
Yep.
Because we, as I said, we always make mistakes in this business.
So I wanted to get to, you know, your point on how you started in the business. Then, you know, you're working at Omega for Lee Cooperman. A lot of that was very kind of fundamental research, to your point, getting to know the business better than the CFOs. And, you know, I sent you an email. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but I thought David Einhorn made an interesting comment late last week where he basically said the markets are fundamentally broken. And I think what he meant by that is that the fundamentals maybe are less important now. And, you know, he went on to say that when, you know, he's sort of a value investor and alongside, I think, and he looks for even greater margins of safety. But I'm curious about your thoughts on sort of fundamental analysis and investing and how that's changed over the last couple decades.
Yeah, I read your email, which prompted me to listen to Ritholtz's interview and Masters of Business on Bloomberg, which was a really great interview. And basically to summarize his position, and I've been writing about this, as you know, for a long period of time. Market structure has really distorted the markets. Over 50% of the assets under management in the hedge fund business worshiped at the altar of price momentum, whether it's risk parity, you know, vol funds, dispersion funds. And it's these quant funds and the proliferation of exchange traded funds also have really, as Dave Einhorn says, disadvantaged value investors. And it's very true. But I run a true long-short fund. And a lot of my basic precepts, for example, pairs trading, gets back to Alfred Winslow, the original hedged fund manager back in 1949, who bought the best companies and industries and shorted the worst. And I do a lot of that. And it tends to result in non-correlated returns against the market, which I think in the looking prospectively is probably a great place to be.
Right.
But, you know, Lee taught me not only to work hard, but to, you know, I've been modeling my whole life. And we listen to narratives, as Keith discusses, every day on financial TV, which is based on gut and feel.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street.
Go to HedgeEye.com/research to subscribe.
Enjoy the rest of this episode.
So a lot of people, you know, have given up shorting. And I thought this was interesting. I think earlier this year, before you went off Twitter, you had a post. I think it was a reference to somebody mentioning they had generational longs. And then you said, well, actually, I have some generational shorts, CHGG, FMC, FIGS, Hood, Riley, one of our favorites, MPW. So I'm kind of curious, you know, you're sort of going the other way and saying, there are still great shorts out there. And I don't know if there's a couple you can talk about or maybe...
I prefer Jonesy Buds not to talk about my shorts, generally speaking.
Or maybe common characteristics.
I would talk about a pair trade, for example.
Okay.
I'll give you an ideal situation. Remember, Alfred Winslow was the first hedge fund manager. He called it hedge fund in those days. And, you know, he made his bones by doing pair trades. And a good pair trade is very valuable because it's a decision both on the long side and the short side. It's really not a pair at all, but people think of it as a pair. So let me tell you a good example of both companies you're very familiar, particularly the latter.
Yeah.
So we've been long Goldman Sachs under $300, and we've been short B. Riley, which is a a real problem. I don't have to tell you about the fundamentals, so go into it. A real problematic third or fourth tier
broken
leverage, which faces what I think are in problems that inevitably are going to lead to something close to a bankruptcy. We shorted the stock 55 into a secondary. You may remember last year there was a large secondary that they sold to their retail investors. So we buy Goldman Sachs at 300. It's close to 400 now. And B. Riley's gone from 55 to 19.
Yep.
That's a perfect pairs trade. And we do a lot. And there's purity to that. You don't see it anymore. The big guys like Dan Loeb, I remember reading Dan a third point when he talked about why he was no longer shorting. And the fact of the matter is, I can do it with a $100 million hedge fund.
Yep.
He can't do it with a $10 or $12 billion hedge fund.
Right.
Lee couldn't do it with a $12 billion hedge fund, Omega Advisors. You can't create the critical mass on the short side unless you're doing spoos.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so circling back to the financial media, you know, you and I talked a little bit about this beforehand, but you at one point were fairly prolific. To your point, you're on the Kudlow Show a couple times a week. We used to see you on CNBC a lot. But at some point, something changed.
Nothing happened. Yeah. What happened was, so I was a guest host from around 2003 to 2014. So I was on, that meant twice a month. And remember, a guest host in the old days, I was on Squawk Box. In the old days, this is when Mark Haynes was there with Kernan and Carl Quintanilla, and then David took over Faber. And in those days, a guest host was on for 3 hours, had an opportunity, like I do right now, guest hosting Market Surveillance on Bloomberg with Keene Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz, to expand your points. Today, a guest host on CNBC, Squawk Box, spends 10 minutes on air. So it's much different. So what happened was, I had sent an email. I was short at the time. I was short of Apple at the time. It actually went down 45% in the 10-month period I was short. I forgot what year it was. And I sent an email to Scott Wapner, who's a friend of mine, still a friend of mine, who was hosting, wasn't called Halftime. I forgot the show. It was
Halftime Report, I think, yeah.
No, it was way before Halftime.
Oh, okay.
And it was a 4 o'clock show. And he made a big deal about Lee Cooperman, my friend, buying Apple. And that was a period in which Apple was the topic of conversation about 3 hours a day on CNBC. And I wrote an email to him, personal email, that said, "You're being hyperbolic, Scott. What you have to do is look at what percentage of the portfolio his Apple buy represent." And it represented less than 0.3%. So someone intercepted the email at CNBC and sent it to the New York Post. The next day on page 6, the cover story was a picture of a Miami Dolphin cheerleader saying, and underneath the caption, "Doug Cass says CNBC are a bunch of cheerleaders."
Oh,
so
geez.
That's when the fight ensued, and that's when I shifted to Bloomberg. They didn't want me on. I didn't want to be on because they didn't own up. They didn't fess up to what they did.
And you've become more outspoken over time. And maybe to your point, it's about this change in the media too. I like this quote that you tweeted probably a month or two ago. But you said, in a way, by providing a continuing platform, the business media platforms are accomplices to the theft of investors' monies. And I think that's your point. It sort of nails your point that everything is short-term oriented. Nobody gets time to talk. There's a lot of biases behind what people are saying. And then also to your
right, that was referencing Kathy Wood, and in a Morning Star column the next week, the reporter concluded that she's eviscerated $14 billion of retail investors' money. But so she's provided a platform continually in the business media, which I think is absolutely disgusting. The other objection I have, and this has been my ongoing objection, and I mean, there are obvious reasons why this is the case, but if you fail, like what you guys do so well is you memorialize your winners and losers. Everything is time-stamped.
Yep.
Nothing is time-stamped in financial TV. Nothing is memorialized. So viewers can't assess how value added the contribution is with each panelist. Since so many of the recommendations are based on feeling gut and collapse with such regularity, it's even worse. So it gets me upset. That's why I'm staying off Twitter, because I manifest how upset I am
right in
tweets. And I really want to spend my time running money successfully.
Totally understand that. I wanted to get to some of, every year you do, I think, top 10 surprises for the coming year. I think, in part it's serious, in part there's some levity in it. But I thought a couple were interesting, and I'm just curious to get any updated thoughts you have. I think number three this year is there's neither a soft landing nor a hard landing, just very sluggish real growth in the U.S. economy. And I think actually that's sort of what we're seeing so far. But I'm curious if you have any new thoughts on that.
I think I call this slugflation, sluggish growth and prickly inflation, particularly apropos in light of the inflation print today.
Right.
And I think as we, Lee Cooperman talks, he invokes Joseph, who talks about the Pharaoh in the Bible, that we're going to have seven lean years following seven fat years. And I think that's the case. I think too many people are looking at disinflation towards 2% and not recognizing the secular impact of stacked or cumulative inflation, which is over 20% over the last 3-4 years. And that's going to contribute not only to the slugflation that I anticipate, but also to this continued widening the schism between the haves and have-nots, which results in large measure with this partisanship and the extremism on the political left and the extremism on the political right, which creates partisanship in an environment where we have to address the biggest challenge, which is obviously our national debt load and our annual deficit. And nothing's going to happen because of the widening schism.
We actually
I have a good one. I like my Elon Musk. Let's see. Do you have a list of it in front of you? Surprise number 8.
Yeah,
Jonesy, what would the surprise list be without Elon Musk?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was a funny one.
And actually, it seems to be occurring. It is revealed that Elon Musk suffers some serious addiction, entering an extended stay in rehab. Musk is forced to temporarily relinquish operating control of his company's Tesla. Shares fall back to the lows of 2023.
By the way, I'm curious, have you ever been a Tesla shareholder on the long side?
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Absolutely not. I'm short Tesla.
Okay.
I'm short of Tesla, as my friend Dennis Gartman says.
Yeah, exactly.
Gold terms, in absolute terms.
Another thing you've talked a fair bit about is private equity, and I don't know if it's maybe a bit of a ticking time bomb, but I'm sort of curious how you think the private equity, it was a bit of a bubble, or maybe more than a bit of a bubble, for a long period of time just because of interest rates and how low they were, and it was sort of easy money. But you know, when we look prospectively to this year and in coming years, you know, what happens to that industry?
Well, I've gotten a firsthand look at private equity by virtue. I sat on a number of New York Stock Exchange boards, and one of the boards was a business development company, what they call BDCs. And I've seen firsthand what the marks are. And they're basically ridiculous. So my surprise seven, as I recall, was in my surprise list for 2024, was that Wall Street's most vicious vultures, private equity, are about to get torn to shreds.
Right.
With still elevated interest rates, especially in the second half of the year, and a slowing global economy, with loan rate resets contribute to a leader in private credit failing. Blackstone shares dropped by a third after BREIT, their private real estate fund run by Blackstone, and BXMT come under redemption pressures, and that shares of other private equities stocks, Apollo, KKR, plunge as the SEC opens an investigation into the failure of the private equity industry to realistically mark to market their portfolios in a timely manner. I have small shorts. In the market decline, I took in most of my shorts, but I have been reshorting the sector right now.
Well, I think BREIT in particular is an interesting one, right? You know, I don't know how long the gates have been up now, but you know, there's a lot of money that I think still wants to come out of there. And you know, the asset values continues to be very questionable. So, you know, we get asked this question a lot. And you know, I think in general, we probably have similar views of the economy and you know, where we're going and the risks. But what would make you more, I guess, optimistic or excited? You know, maybe want to get more long, you know, be excited about sort of the intermediate term view of the U.S. economy. I guess, what would you have to see or what would have to change?
Sure. Yeah. Let me start by saying, when I wake up every morning, Jonesy, I have three questions that I repeatedly ask myself when I am thinking about investing Seabreeze capital. Unfortunately, I still don't like the answers to the questions. Number one, in a paperless and cloudy world, are investors and citizens as safe as the markets assume we are? Number two, in a flat, networked, and interconnected world, is it even possible for America to be an oasis of prosperity and a driver of engine of global economic growth? And three, with the G7's geopolitical coordination at an all-time low, how slow and inept will the reaction be if the wheels come off? So these are my concerns. I will give you 8 or 10 additional concerns. I'll give you the Cliff Note edition. One, the world is getting less safe. Two, globalization is being replaced by nationalism, serving to reduce corporate international top-line growth and representing a threat to the bottom line and margins. Three, as I mentioned just before, our unelected monetary authorities and fiscal policymakers remain horribly weak in their forecasting ability, implementation, and effectiveness of policy. Fourth, as I said also, we have extremely partisan domestic politics. It augurs poorly for any fiscal discipline, and I'm afraid with regard to controlling or reducing the U.S. deficit. Number five, it's my view, and I think it's your view, that consensus forecasts for global economic and corporate profit growth estimates are totally unrealistic. Six, as I mentioned before, the cumulative or stacked increase in inflation since 2000 will be felt over the next couple of years, contributing to a period of likely slugflation. Seven, short-dated Treasury yields still exceed 5%. These are at record spreads relative to the lowly S&P dividend yield, which just hit a low of 1.46%, an all-time low. Eight, and this is really important, the equity risk premium, which is the inverse of the PE, less a risk-free rate of return, is arguably the best predictor of future stock returns or outcomes. It's nearly a multi-decade low. Number nine, something we alluded to, much like 1987, market structure risks, we talked about active versus passive, right, are expanding geometrically as dispersion and other products manufactured by banks are a little accepted threat to market stability. It's something that your tier one group discusses all the time.
Yep.
Number 10, investor sentiment, which follows stock prices, are overly ebullient. Household exposure to equities is at a near record high level. And finally, valuations remain elevated by historic standards, in excess of a 90 percentile and traditional metrics. So I think that the downside risk dwarfs the upside return going forward.
But as a fund manager, I don't know exactly how you manage your fund, but I assume you do have some longs, or you need some longs. But so I'm curious what you're finding out there that is compelling or is valuable. Maybe it's certain sectors. I don't know if you want to get into specific positions, but
as kind of non-consensus guy, I have been. You'll probably agree, when you trade commodity-based stocks like energy stocks, stocks, I treat these stocks as trading sardines because they're dependent upon the commodity. So I have a bunch of trading sardines in the oil area, which I trade back and forth. I do think that there is a chance that energy becomes an interesting secular theme based upon growing political instability, which is one of my major surprises. But generally speaking, I tend to look at out of favor stocks. But Einhorn is right. You know, you can't, because of market structure changes, we can no longer look for 10 and 11 multiple stocks and hope they go to 13 to 14. We have to start looking as value investors at 5 or 6 multiple stocks.
Yep.
And hope they go up and buy back stock.
So I like to ask this to people that have had a lot of experience in the business, and I think you're a really good great example of somebody to ask because you take such great notes. But you know, looking back at your career, what was a big mistake you made, and what did you get wrong? And maybe this is a specific investment, maybe it's a market call at some period of time. But you know, and then
that's a great question that no one asks. I would say that I think let's talk about what I missed in the last 3 months.
Okay.
So I've been net short. I've been directionally wrong for 60 or 90 days. I underestimated the animal spirits and the price momentum that accumulated during November and December. I underestimated the power of the herd as the pressure to the upside intensified, and so did FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Yep.
I underestimated the aforementioned market structure changes, which have, in terms of intensifying the upside to equity, specifically, as I said, quant strategies like risk parity that worship at the altar of price momentum, they catalyzed the market advance. Active managers then came along for the ride. And in essence, we live in a world, I like to say, where buyers live higher and sellers live lower, which is in conflict with Warren Buffett, who says, in the short run, the market is a weighing machine, is a voting machine, but in the long run, it's a weighing machine.
Yeah, that's a great quote.
The same mistake I made with regard to interest rate. The momentum of yield to the downside accelerated. So there was more and more buying as yields went lower of fixed income products. I thought interest rates would decline, but I underestimated the valuation reset higher in equities, even in the face of weakening high-frequency economic data. And finally, I overestimated the concerns that would accompany lower interest rates and didn't anticipate the possibility that price-earnings multiples would expand to the degree they did. It's my strong and not consensus conviction that the market's upside reward is now likely dwarfed materially by downside risk.
Yeah. And we may be seeing the start of that today. I have to ask you about crypto, Bitcoin, that asset class. I'm guessing I know what you think of it, but I'm curious to kind of hear it from your own mouth. And have you ever been involved long or short in any of these assets?
No. I mean,
not meaningful.
I can't.
Yeah.
Nothing meaningful.
Yep.
I don't understand Bitcoin. And I think one of the problems with the business media and panelists that appear on financial TV is they don't know those three words. I don't know. And when I don't know and I don't understand something, I say something. I don't answer every question as an authority. And I admit when my education or information is deficient for me to have a judgment.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And in fact, I kind of feel the same way. And, you know, we view them more as commodities and trading vehicles to some extent. But, you know, I think it's perfectly well to say you don't know. So I'm going to wrap it up here. We like to keep these just around half an hour. But I think the last question I'd like to ask you, and we have a lot of people that are new to investing. I don't know if you have any tips or ideas for somebody that maybe just at the age where they're starting to invest, take a more active interest in their portfolio. What do you do to educate yourself and, you know, start to get up the curve of doing more yourself?
I'll tell you how I started. My grandma Koufax was a feminist way back. And she had her own business. She had a women's wear business called Koufax Hughes Centers in the Bronx in Westchester. And she was an avid investor. And I was 15 years old, and she started to teach me by giving me a notebook and said to me, select a bunch of stocks. Every week, watch the price action and read the financial media reports and try to understand the price fluctuation in the aforementioned stocks. It became a hobby. And then instead of taking vacations to Fort Lauderdale, I spent my holidays at the local Merrill Lynch brokerage firm. In those days, they had galleries of chairs and you watch a ticker tape.
Right.
And I was just fascinated. It was like reading a book to me. And I tried to understand the price movement. So try to understand price movements. Pick a portfolio of stocks, Peter Lynch, that you know, McDonald's, et cetera. Try to understand the weekly and monthly price change. As an investor, I agree with Warren Buffett, who says the first $10,000 you put into the market, you should probably buy spiders or Qs. You should buy index funds,
yeah,
basically, and then learn from there. By the way, the thrill of my lifetime was one morning at 6 o'clock, I'm watching Squawk Box. This is when I was still an ally of CNBC. It's 6:01 and Warren Buffett is there being interviewed by Becky Quick, my friend. And it was the Monday after he released the annual report. The annual report, he says, I want to do something different in 2014 at the annual meeting for Berkshire Hathaway. I want to invite a credential bear to ask tough questions. I'm kind of getting bored with the questions from the journalists and from the peanut gallery and shareholders. I sat between Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett in front of 40,000 sycophants, devotees at the annual meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. I brought my son who was getting his doctorate in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania where I attended business school. And it was a special treat for me to be with my son because he really didn't understand what I did for a living. I was a credentialed bear. I walked up to the dais and spent 7 hours with them. I was booed on the way up. And at the end, I was cheered. I asked very respectful questions, but tough questions. Like, for example, Warren, you have said that on your death, the executive chairman will be your son, Howard Buffett. Howard Buffett has never been involved in investing in it as a farmer. Explain the rationale. You know, so I did it tactfully.
Yeah.
And it was great. I also asked him to give me $150 million to run on a short fund. And if I didn't outperform Berkshire's portfolio, I'd give back his fee.
That's great.
And that's fun because I went in with Lee Cooperman, playing Mary Gabelli with Steve Roth, chairman of Renato, my good buddy, who was his plane, Andrew Ross Sorkin, Marty Cohen from Cohen & Steers, a great real estate investor, my son, Steve Roth's son-in-law, Michael Salzhauer, a very dear friend to this day. And Steve Roth and Michael Salzhauer had Dougie the Bear shirts, which they all wore, including Cooperman.
That's awesome. So,
class of 14 on the back. It was a special weekend.
Yeah, that's a very, very cool story. Well, anyways, we're going to wrap it up there, Doug, but I really appreciate you coming on. I love that we've come full circle with you and look forward to doing more with you in the future.
I'm very happy that I am now an ally and a subscriber. I learn every day from you and Keith. I mean it. I'm not being patronizing, and everyone should subscribe.
Really appreciate it, Doug. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.